There is this thing.
Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Hello, it is just past 5 o'clock on Tuesday, March 26th, and you are listening to Off the Hour on CKUT, and today it's the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup. I'm your host, Jules, and I'm going to be sharing some of the work that I've been doing here at the station with the support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada. We're starting off the hour with an interview with Lydia Khalil of the Ligue des Droits et Libertés about an event they've got coming up tomorrow night. It's a film screening and panel discussion on police and profiling in Montreal. Later on the program, you're going to hear some coverage of the TA strike that's ongoing at McGill, the loss of a children's bookstore in Montreal, Mile End, and an interview from last week about the growing opposition to Quebec's Comité des Sages, their so-called Wise Men Committee on Gender Identity and Expression. All that to come for the next hour on CKUT. Stay tuned. Last summer, the Montreal Police released a second report they commissioned on street checks and racial profiling. It found that racialized people are disproportionately targeted by random street checks in the city, and there's been little change since the last report in 2019, despite the police adopting a policy on the practice in 2021. Nevertheless, the SPVM still refuses to end the practice. Now, tomorrow night, the Ligue des Trois et Libertés are hosting a film screening discussion on that and the larger theme of police and profiling, in collaboration with the National Film Board and the Observatoire des Profilages. It's part of a series of events for the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And you can find more details on the LDL's website. I spoke to the Ligue des Droits et Libertés' Linda Khalil, who'll be one of tomorrow night's panelists, about some of the problems facing folks here in Montreal when it comes to police and profiling. Take a listen. Why don't you tell me a little bit about the documentary you're screening on Wednesday and the kind of conversation you want to start around police and profiling? Like, you know, what are some of the issues that we're talking about, especially here in Montreal, when we talk about, you know, racial profiling at the hands of the police?
So racial profiling is one of many problems when we talk about police. And it's a violation of the rights of Indigenous people and racialized people. And it's a problematic that is well known by authorities. It has been denounced for decades. And we can observe that nothing concrete in terms of action has been taken by authorities. They have passed through the last decades by a denial that they didn't recognize there was a problem of racial profiling. Then they recognized it, but they said, oh, but it's an individual problem. It's like bad apples problem. And then they also said it's a problem of the people perception of the work of police officer. Like if people have a wrong perception of police work. And now we are still in that kind of situation, which is police and political authorities will say, okay, there is a problem of racial profiling, but the way they define the problem is very problematic because they still define it like maybe some officers sometimes may do some intervention that are not respecting the right to equality. But what we know is that it's a systemic problematic. It's within the whole organization. It's not like an individual one. It's with practices. It's at the core of the police structure, and there are a lot of action that must be taking place. And one first type of action is to reduce police power and reduce the sphere of possibility of intervention by police officers, or it's reduced contacts by police with people that are marginalized and targeted by police. One of the way for that, for example, if we take the practice of street checks, that is one of the root of racial profiling and social profiling, because people that are being more targeted by this practice are Indigenous people, racialized people, Black people, and people in situation of marginality in public space. And also we know that police do not have the power to do street checks. So we launched a campaign with dozens of organizations to revendicate that there will be a ban on street checks. For now, at the Montreal level, at the provincial level, there is a very strong resistance for that, but it's a struggle that must continue. And what we also observe is that, for example, in Montreal, the new police chief, Fadi Daguerre, is saying, yeah, it's a real issue, racial profiling, I'm taking care of. I will work on training and on having more diversity within my staff. But what we know is that those two type of action has been repeated for like 30 years. It doesn't change. We cannot be against training, but it's not training that will target the root of the problem. But right now, we see that for media, for example, they say, oh, he's taking it seriously, he's in action. But the action, it's a smoke screen completely. And that's the situation where we are, and we must continue to put pressure, because it's by a long-standing pressure that some changes can occur.
So just for anybody who hasn't undergone one, which is probably a lot of people who will be listening, what is a street check, and how does that kind of interaction with police, if you are especially a racialized person, Indigenous person, like, you know, how does that sort of alter your comfort or your movement within public space?
Okay, so basically a street check is when you are in public space and a police officer came to a person and asked for the identity of the person and asked some questions. So in this interaction, the person has no legal obligation to give its identity to police officer. It's possible legally to just ignore the police officer and just continue to walk. But in the reality, so when they do street check police, very often they will not tell the person, you can go if you want, you don't have to, but I'm asking you to give me your identity, but you can walk away if you want. They don't do that. And it's an interaction of power. And they count on that. They count on the person not knowing his rights, or knowing it, but being not sure what will be the consequence if I'm telling the police officer what are my rights and that I can leave. Some reports about street checks in Montreal and also in Repentigny in the last years shown very clearly and confirm what was already known and tell by racialized people, Indigenous people, Black people. It's that police will do more often street check within certain communities. Also, what the report demonstrate, it's that it's not because there are more infraction or crimes within those communities, which is a prejudice that some people will say, oh, it's normal, it's because there is more crime. But no, it's not true. And the recent report from 2023 in Montreal, one of the recommendations was to do a moratorium on street checks. And it has been completely rejected by the new director. And the consequence for people being targeted is their rights. So they have a rights right of liberty to circulate in public space, and they have a right for protection against arbitrary detention, and it affects the dignity of people to being always targeted by police. And also what police can do with the personal information that they can get with a street check. So they can decide to put it in a police database for intelligence purpose. But when they do that, you don't know that they have put your personal information in that database, and they can use it after. So if a person has been street checked once, and then without knowing all the personal information is in this database, another police officer will do another street check and say, oh, your information is in this database. So it must be because I have a good reason, because my colleague several weeks ago did the same thing. So it will just like create more target on individuals. And we know that people, and there is also the problem to make the difference between street checks in the streets, and police do not have the legal power to do that. And there is a difference with interception on the road. So random interception of driver. This is another problematic practice that is at the root of racial profiling. And it has been demonstrated by reports and a recent decision of the Superior Court that Black people are more targeted by this practice. And it's a police power. It's within the Highway Safety Code, and it was a common law power. And now it has been challenged in front of the courts to say, well, this power must be considered unconstitutional because it violates human rights.
So I think a lot of people listening are going to hear this, and like, you know, a lot of our listeners, I would say, are pretty critical of the police. But if you leave and go to other media or you go online, right, you hear a lot of people talking about how Montreal is getting less safe. They want more cops, basically. A lot of people seem to be drumming up support for more policing, whether it's in the STM or it's on our streets. You know, police budgets increase every year. We've seen massive increases over the past 4 years or so. How do we separate, I guess, people's feelings of unsafety with the actual unsafety that like racialized people face when we increase this kind of police presence throughout public life? Like, how do we sort of put in a policy that's actually fair to people and doesn't target people without having this big backlash that just results in much more policing of public space?
Well, we can first say that every person has rights that must be respected, and everyone. And doing racial and social profiling will not make the majority more safe. So it's like we have to deconstruct that. And maybe people more often will make an association by police and safety, but safety of communities must be and can be made differently. So the way to do that, when we often hear police saying we are working on prevention, but it's a tricky word because it depends who use it. So when police say we are doing prevention to assure security, what we must hear is we are doing profiling, and it equals rights violation of people, and it will not make the communities and society more safe. And the real prevention is outside police services. So the real prevention is when we talk about economic and social rights, what are programs, what is the government doing within community organization, but in assuring the right to housing, the right to food, the right to having all those economic and social rights being respected and being at the root of public services. And now we are seeing that the government is not, and it has been for decades, but it's not doing sufficient investments in realizing economic and social rights. And so it's the condition of people to live in dignity and to have all the rights respected that is the real prevention to social problems. And it's not by having more police officers or having more funding in some programs that, for example, body cams. It's not targeting the root of the problems. But it's true that for some people, they will say, I have never been targeted by a police officer. I have never been street checked. But maybe it's because if a person is within the majority group, they will not be. But it's to sensibilize people to be in the shoe of those who repeatedly are being targeted and how their sentiment of community is like is falling to say, I see the difference how I am being treated with a white person and as a black person I have been treated.
If people want more information, I guess, if they want to have a larger discussion, like we've just sort of skimmed the surface here, there's so much more we could talk about, but then they should probably come to the event on Wednesday, right?
Yeah, we invite everyone to come to the projection. So it's this Wednesday, March 27th, and it's at 7 p.m. at the ONF, the National Film Board. And we can discuss racial profiling, and then the discussion for sure will go more larger. What is the role of police and how police does not equal safety for communities. And there are so much more to talk, like when we talk about racial profiling, it's also the use of force, the arrests, and the surveillance of communities, how the police with its dominant discourses will construct the idea that they must do some surveillance practices to assure security. So it's also a struggle to deconstruct those discourses.
And that's for our Francophone or bilingual listeners primarily. But Linda, thank you so much for coming on CKUT. I really appreciate it.
Thanks to you for the invitation.
Spring Into Action, Outrage is happening March 11th through 24th. Spring Into Action is an annual event series that is organized and funded by QPIRG McGill and SSMU. Every spring, QPIRG organizes a week of free workshops, discussions, film screenings, and social events engaging local and global issues. We have an exciting lineup of events, including a screen printing workshop, community dinner and zine making night, Prison Abolition 101, and other practical and capacity building workshops for organizing in the midst of injustice and anger. Check out the schedule of events at qpergmcgill.org or on our Instagram at qpergmcgill.
Last fall's protests against queer and trans-inclusive education have borne fruit here in Quebec. Premier François Legault responded to September 20th's so-called 1 million March for Children, where groups asked for topics of gender and sexuality to be kept out of schools with a government committee. This Committee of Wise Men, as it's being called, is consulting with community groups and will advise the government on policies towards trans and non-binary people. But how far will the government go to placate the growing parents' rights movement? And will it come at the expense of trans children? Launched just yesterday, the Nous ne serons pas sages coalition brings together over 100 organizations, activists, and researchers to call for the dissolution of the Comité des Sages. Joining me is coalition spokesperson Zayel Gour. Zayel, thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I just want to get started with understanding this Comité des Sages. What are the issues that are here with this new committee. Why did your group launch this campaign yesterday?
Basically, the very existence of the committee is something we oppose. It is built on the notion there is an issue with trans people, our existence, our presence, and the fact that we're being discussed in medias and television. Beyond just gender education in school, what the Million March organizers and all of the other far-right protests we've seen are, they're really calling for the disappearance of trans people in public life. And by simply creating this committee, Legault is giving weight to their demands. He said basically that they are reasonable concerns that need to be heard. And for us, that's very insulting because those people come from far-right extremist religious groups. They are, we like on the ground, because we were, many of us were on the ground during those protests. And what people are reporting said that those people were calling slurs, were violent, they attacked people. Those are not reasonable people. They're members of the organized religious far-right. And it's surprising for a government that has played themselves as like the good governance type to play on those fears. And beyond that, the committee is in no way legitimate to decide or recommend anything concerning trans people. There's no trans people involved in the committee. And there isn't even someone that has like experience working with trans youth or trans people in general. They're all fully inapt in this mission. And two of the committee members have expressed ideas that are like marked by transphobia and or have ties with organized transphobic groups.
Yeah, and you know, when you say that François Legault is appealing to far-right actors and, you know, intense religious groups, what exactly are their demands? Like, what would they like to see in terms of, you know, inclusive education around gender and sexual orientation, gender identity, things like that? What are they pushing for that the CAC government is sort of like considering or giving credence to by putting this committee forward?
It depends. The people that organized the protest last fall were a broad coalition of right wing and mainly far right groups. And they didn't came out with like a very clear, like, are we on those policies? Basically, depending who's talking to them and the context, they're always moving the goalpost. Anything that is inclusive of trans people, they have a problem with, especially when it comes to young people. They are opposed to education, that just explains the fact that trans people exist. That's, even this is, for many of them, is too much. Just saying trans people exist in a school context. They, one of the big thing too is they want the same kind of legislation we've seen in Alberta and New Brunswick and Saskatchewan that force the outing of trans youth to their parents, and which is very dangerous. One of the main perpetrators of violence against trans youths are their own families. In many contexts, families are not a safe environment for trans youth. Like trans youth are overrepresented in the trans homeless population. And the main reason is because they're being pushed on the street by their own parents because they are trans. And it's also true for other queer folks. They're pushing against the drag story hours. They're pushing against access to trans medical care, which is proven to be life-saving. And beyond that, they are inviting violence against trans people, especially when there isn't as much cameras around, or like the groups we've seen in the streets are not simply like concerned actors, they're hate groups. And Legault is kind of playing balls without not fully endorsing them, but saying that their concerns need to be listened to. But by the composition of the committee and the way it was framed, it's clear that he's not setting it up to be something that's going to condemn those concerns.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in there because I think it's important to really talk about the Comité des Sages, the sort of wise men committee, and who are the so-called wise men, who the government has chosen here, because, you know, that's been a large part of the opposition from groups like yours, is just that the people who are leading the committee don't have expertise with the community, the trans community. You know, is that sort of all there is to it, just that these people are not experienced, or is there more to the story here?
There's a lot more here. The president of the committee is someone called Diane Lavallée, And Diana Valli has been, it's been found that she has like a deep personal friendship with Diane Guibaud, which is now dead, but used to be the president of Pour le droit des femmes du Québec, PDF Québec, which is a TERF group.
Sorry, could you explain TERF?
Oh, sorry. It's a trans radical exclusive feminist group. Basically, it's a group that revendicates, like that claims itself to be feminist, but who oppose the inclusion of trans people within feminism. They're also Islamophobic, and they oppose the rights of sex workers. And Diane Lavallée had a friendship with Diane Guibaud, who used to be the president of PDF Québec, and she also published a video on the website of PDF Québec giving homage to that director. And in this video, she defended and she praised the fact that Diane Guibaud fought against the dangerous ideas of intersectionality, which she said we needed to raise a red flag against.
Avec les enjeux que ça comporte, Diane a été capable d'allumer les lumières rouges qu'il fallait, bien qu'elle reconnaît dans l'intersectionnalité.
In this video tribute to Diane Guilbeault, Diane Lavallée says that the former is a woman who understands the positive benefits of intersectionality for Indigenous women, lesbians, and others, but also is able to turn on the red lights about its dangers. She also calls her the perfect portrait of the committed feminist activist at all times.
And Diane Guibaud basically opposed the fact that a trans woman was elected president of the One Federation. She called out what she called like the trans lobby from taking over feminist space. And so her ties, the ties of Diane Lavallée, it's a bit confusing. There's two Diane there, but basically Diane Lavallée is the president of the Wiseman Council, and her ties with PDF Québec are very worrying. PDF Québec created fake scandals framing trans activists as pedophile for talking about gender euphoria. They said that gender euphoria was a fetish, a sexual fetish, and that talking about gender euphoria to children amounted to a sex crime against children. While gender euphoria just is the term to use when someone feels good in their gender expression. So it's like fully misleading, and it's a fear campaign. And so the ties, having someone on the council with ties to PDF Québec is more than worrying. It's revealing of the agenda from Legault, which has maintained close ties with PDF Québec because they were the only woman group to back the Bill 21 when it was passed. And another member of the committee, Patrick Taillon, has expressed itself on Radio-Canada and Cub Radio about the fact that schools should be outing trans kids to their parents, that schools don't have a right to keep that information away from their parents.
Personnellement, je comprends.
This is Patrick Taillon speaking on Cub Radio back in September. In this interview, he's outlining the differences of opinion about whether educators should ask for parental consent or tell the families of transgender children when they choose to go by different pronouns in schools. He says, personally, I understand the argument of insecurity, but the state cannot be responsible for families who have prejudices.
Basically playing on what has been called parental rights, the rights of parents, which for anyone listening that isn't aware, it's not a real thing in any form of legal context. Parents don't have a right as parents, but children have a right in many national, provincial, and international documents. Parental rights were invented by the far-right evangelical preachers in the U.S. to oppose, basically, the end of segregation in school and to oppose progressive education. And it's being imported in Quebec right now through this notion of, like, parents have a right to prevent their kid from being exposed to diversity and to prevent their kid from being trans, basically. From parents should, like, agree to the school respecting their kids' pronouns. That's one of the things he also said, that parents should have like their say in this matter.
Yeah, so there's a lot in there, but it sounds like what you're saying is that, you know, there's this uniquely, I guess, Quebecois network, right? Where the PDF is this group that came to political prominence within the CAQ for their support of Bill 21, their opposition to wearing the hijab in this very like secularist kind of brand of feminism. And because of that link, you know, they're now being really included in this committee, but you're also bringing up this larger context in which terms like parents' rights started in the United States, migrated here. Even the protests that we saw, the 1 Million March for Children, which was called anti-SOGI, right? It was like, yep. SOGI stands, I think, for sexual orientation, gender identity. It's a type of curriculum you can have in schools. But those protests happened, exactly, they happened here, but the actual curriculum didn't exist in Quebec. So we have on the one hand something that's uniquely Quebecois, and on the other hand something that is completely imported from an outside context. And I'm curious to hear from you about what are the sort of elements that might make what's happening here different from what's happening in other contexts. Is there anything about the story in this Comité des Sages that, you know, is something distinct from what we're seeing in other contexts?
There's a few different things. One of the things that's important to realize is that Quebec has been for years a, not necessarily a bastion, but a strong place for trans movement and trans-related issue. Like, statistically, many studies have shown that, like, Francophones are one of the main groups when polled in Canada that would say that they would support their kid coming out as trans. And Quebec has, for a long time, had amongst the most progressive law regarding to trans issues. And so there isn't the same popular support, or at least there wasn't the same popular support for transphobic things. And so that's one of the reasons I think Legault cannot just put a bill right now that would be transphobic. He tried, basically, he already tried with Bill 2 2 years ago, basically, a bit more than 2 years ago, which was theorized to be probably something that was proposed by PDF Quebec, because they were the only group that came out in support of the bill, even amongst the right wing here. And so there's something very Quebecois about the first going through a wise man council. It's the same thing they did with Bill 21. It's basically trying to give legitimacy, trying to build support for those issues, give them a sense of credibility by creating basically an expert council of ideologues. And so that's very Quebecois. That's a really CAC thing to go to do, like building the ground before you can like really make a political push in that direction. But otherwise, I think it's really an import of things that were happening outside of Quebec. It's not innate, like a native is maybe not the right word, but like it's not a locally grown movement. It's really coming from the Anglo-Saxon world, meaning England and the like southern United States. And amongst our coalition, there's a bunch of anti-fascist groups like Montreal Anti-Fascists or Pink Bloc or others that weren't really involved during the counter-protests against this. And they also infiltrated, but they found ways to have access to information from within those groups. And we know that it was never again about SOGI. Like, it's one of the clear things. It's when they name specific policies or stuff like that, it's never really about this. It's always about just a larger moral panic that's been created by the media, a larger demonization of trans people. And if you go for any like trans-related post online, you will see all those people creeping out, calling trans and queer people pedophiles, saying they should be killed. It's really the discourse we're walking with. It's a fascistic leaning movement. And so this is really not something that came out of Quebec. The Quebec far right has been mainly dead for many years, since 2016, 2017. But Legault is really giving wind to the sail of a new kind of far right that resemble less what we're usually used to hear and more what's coming from the prairies or the southern states or England.
What's curious, or I guess what remains to be seen, is just how will this succeed? Because in other aspects, right, the CAC project has been very successful. You know, recent polling notwithstanding, if you traditionally have polled François Legault across the rest of Canada's premiers, he has done very, very well. And, you know, if Quebec is starting at a baseline of respect and support for trans rights, but we are seeing these kinds of movements gaining ground, what are the next steps for supporters and defenders and allies of trans rights and trans people? Like, what can people do to get involved?
One thing is we should see it for what it is. It's a moral panic being built through the media and to far-right groups, and we should see that it's something that is built like on a constant repetition, basically, of saying it enough and enough until it becomes serious. And in that sense, we need to oppose this discourse everywhere we see it. We shouldn't give it any sort of legitimacy or not treat it as something that's reasonable. We should oppose it systematically. But other than that, I think it's really important to support a trans-led initiative. I think a lot of why the far right is picking on trans people to build like that more panic is that there's not that many of us. We're a really small percentage of the population. And so we really need people of good conscience to walk with us on the 31st during our protest, but in general to be there when there's a protest that needs to be opposed, but also like to organize event or activities or invite trans people to come speak to in your school, in your union, in your women's group. And we're seeing like a lot of the progressive parts of society, including most of Quebec's feminist group, really coming to this position and realizing that there's a need to like actively get involved. But other than that, like, I think Quebec is less transphobic than it is racist. And I think we're not going to see the same kind of mass participation to this kind of initiative from the government as we saw from for Bill 21. But this, to be said, like, Radio-Canada published a like really transphobic and misinformed, poorly sourced episode of their show Enquête about like trans youth access to healthcare, where they basically gave like a lot of time to Lisa Littman, which is a discredited pseudo-scientific transphobe that had a lot of her research taken out of academic paper, lost a lot of her academic credibility, but Radio-Canada like still gave her hair time and basically build a whole episode like in one of their most popular show along her like thinking. And I think a lot of people in position of power, in position of like inside medias, inside institutions, really need to think carefully about what they're doing, because they're enabling the violent far right. And even the CSIS said that there's a serious risk for extreme violence coming from transphobic groups. And so like people are playing a dangerous game, trying to make like basically to gain political capital or gain like viewers numbers through playing on that moral panic. And I think people should think about their place in history right now, because we're seeing right-wing, far-right politicians, movement gain a lot of power through this. And we've seen what those kind of thing can do in the past. It's not the first moral panic in history. It's not the first one that has been linked with a violent extremist group. And we know what it leads to in history. And I think people should... I don't think people really want to be on the side of the rise of fascism. This ideology leads to the death of trans people, like we've seen with Next Benedict, like we've seen with Brianna Gay. And I think people should think about that and should really think about where they want to be in their storybook around this whole period.
Just to wrap up, I know you talked about there's a march coming up on March 31st.
Yeah.
Can you give more information for those who are looking to join in? What's that all about and how can people get involved here in Montreal?
Yeah, so every year, March 31st is the Trans Day of Visibility and Trans Day of Vengeance. The two names are used by the community. And so in honor of this day and to call for the dissolution of the committee and more widely to oppose transphobia, we are calling at 2 p.m. On the 31st of March at the 600 Fulham Street for a big protest. We want it to be really a moment of coming together and exposing like the scale of our collective power, our solidarity, and our anger toward the like legitimization of transphobia from the government. And it's not a coincidental spot. That's where the Minister of Family has its office.
And Ministry of Education too.
Yeah, the Ministry of Education too, but the Family Minister is the one the Wiseman Council is dependent from, which in itself is really weird because I don't know why it's a family issue, trans stuff. But it's also where on the 31st of March, there was probably the biggest counter-protest in the history of Quebec to oppose the far right, or at least the contemporary history. And it was when the second Million March was supposed to happen, but unions, women groups, student association, and queer militant groups, LGBT association, all came together and had more than 1,000 people facing a few hundred transphobes, and basically blocked them from protesting in any capacity. And so it's really a space that has a recent history of our community and our allies and other groups coming together. And it's also like significant because of what I said, like it's the offices. So I really hope people are going to come through. We're trying to make it fun. It's going to be a more positive protest than the counter protest. We're walking on our own basis. There's going to be, we're like trying to get buses from Sherbrooke and Quebec for people from outside of the city to come in. And we're going to try to have fun activities afterward.
Yeah, great. All right. Well, that's going to be March 31st. And I'm sure that you will be, anyone who's interested will be hearing about it probably more on CKUT as well. But Sahel, thank you so much for coming and chatting with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
When reached for comment by CKUT, the Office of the Minister of Families said that, quote, the committee's work will allow us to make our future decisions in a more informed manner and will help counter the misinformation that currently pollutes the public conversation. Despite questions from CKUT, they did not comment on the reporting about the committee's makeup, including the statements made publicly by the two committee members discussed in this interview. If you'd like to read that reporting directly, you can find that in an article released December 7th from Pivot Magazine in French. It's called Qui sont les sages qui guideront le gouvernement sur la question de l'identité de genre?
Okay, are we ready? I'm Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine. You're listening to CKUT. Keep listening.
Head to McGill campus this week, and you'll probably see picketers. You might even recognize some of them. Starting on Monday, 1,600 McGill TAs have gone on strike, and they're making their voices heard.
When I say union, you say power! Union! Power! Union! Power! Union! Power!
McGill's TA union, AGSEM, held a strike vote last week. They say they had record turnout, with almost 90% of members voting in favor of an exam time strike. TAs are pushing for a number of provisions to make life more affordable, starting with a pay increase. Here's bargaining committee member Dallas Jokic with the details.
So our sort of key demands have been an increase in wages to make us competitive with other top schools in Canada. At schools like U of T or Queen's or McMaster's, TAs are making, $45 to $50 an hour. We make $33.03 at McGill. We're also fighting for healthcare funds to supplement gaps within the health insurance that graduate students have through PGSS. And we're fighting for indexing TA hours to undergraduate enrollment. So basically, in a lot of departments, we're seeing class sizes are staying the same number of students are enrolled, but we're getting less and less TA hours. In psychology, they just cut all the contracts from 180 hours to 150 hours, which is both, you know, a position for overwork of TAs, and it's a declining quality of education for students. And so from McGill, we've really been seeing little movement. Their offers have remained extremely low on wages, and they have, for the most part, refused to consider anything on indexing TA hours to undergraduate enrollment or on a healthcare fund.
Jokic says that with last year's high inflation, McGill's monetary offers would be an effective pay cut. According to the union, the latest offer would see a 4.25% salary increase in the first year, with 2.25% in the second year and 2% in the third and fourth years of the contract. The going rate is around $33 an hour for TA pay, about $13 below the average for Ontario's top research universities. Mobilization Officer Emma McKay says that if McGill wants the reputation of their neighboring schools, they should be willing to pay for it.
The average TA wage at seven other universities that McGill loves to compare itself to, like U of T, York, U Ottawa, Carleton, McMaster, Queen's, and Western, is $46.36 an hour. Actually, it's just increased a little bit because U of T had a strike vote and successfully increased their wage significantly without even having to go on strike. So U of T was much more ready to negotiate. So we don't think it's fair that we make such a little hourly wage compared to these universities where we do the same work at the same quality. And McGill benefits so much off of its reputation, comparing itself to these other universities. And they should pay us in accordance with their reputation.
You might say that it makes sense McGill TAs are paid lower than at schools like U of T. McGill profs are paid lower too. And Montreal is a cheaper place to live. But TA Fanny Tassandi says that even all of that doesn't account for the difference in pay.
So the standard of TA pay at McGill is the highest in Quebec overall, and TAs in other universities in Quebec are also fighting for wage increases. And actually, TAs who are bargaining at UQAM recently publicized a research that compares salaries with, for example, the salaries of TAs at 200 universities while taking into account disparities in cost of living. And they have found that even when disparities in cost of living are taken into account, McGill TAs are still significantly underpaid compared to Toronto TAs.
The U of T president makes about $450,000 a year. The McGill president makes about $490,000 a year. So the president makes more money, and the TAs make over $14 less per hour.
What we've been pushing for is not necessarily we need to get the identical wage of U of T, but we want some kind of plan to catch us up with other top schools in Canada. McGill is like considers itself one of the top schools in the country, one of the top schools in the world, the Harvard of the North, when they are recruiting new students and doing public-facing things. But when it comes to paying its TAs, they don't want to hear any of it. $33.03 an hour might sound okay, but in the context of graduate student work, where those wages are meant to, in many ways, subsidize the research that we do, in many, many departments, students are having to make tough decisions like skipping meals, not affording groceries, having to move because they can no longer afford their rent. And so within the context of grad student life, the wages are just one piece of the picture of people really, really struggling to get by.
Montreal's cost of living may be lower than in Ontario, but it's rising fast. Rent alone went up by over 11% last year, according to Rentals.ca's annual rent report. That's why TAs like Nicholas Vera are fighting not just for pay increases, but a cost of living adjustment, in case inflation goes higher than predicted. Vera says that McGill has the resources for higher pay. It's just not going to workers like him.
And the idea is to protect TAs against, you know, like skyrocketing costs of living and inflation and stuff like that. Unfortunately, every time we brought this up, McGill's like, yeah, but we got to protect our own finances, which is a little silly. They've got a $2 billion endowment and they spend $12 million on TAs. They can afford it.
Now, this is all in the context of the Quebec government's out-of-province tuition hikes, which are slated to begin next fall and will increase out-of-province tuition by $3,000. They'll also change the funding formula for international tuition. McGill's own estimates say they'll lose tens of millions of dollars each year. They responded with a hiring freeze and cross-campus cuts. Even though it's a time of austerity, McGill's TAs are asking that this standard be applied equally, not just to them, but to senior administrators as well.
We just heard last week, or a couple weeks ago, at this like funding town hall from McGill, that you know it was time to tighten the belt, that we're going to have to do some austerity. And yet they also told us that administrator salaries will not be affected. For some comparison, administrators, like all 40 or so of the administrators at McGill, make about $12 million combined. All 2,000 TAs at McGill make about $12 million combined.
This may sound like an abstract grievance, but Axum says that there are concrete consequences, and that most of those are being felt not just by TAs, but by the thousands of students that they help across campus and across departments.
We know as educators, and students know as students, that getting qualitative, rich feedback, getting one-on-one conversations with your teaching assistants is an essential part of your education. And when TA hours are cut, it's not just bad for TAs, it's also really bad for students. And McGill is, you know, has proposed their new budget. They're making sure that the salaries of top administrators stay at the exact same rate. And education isn't always the priority, it seems. So one of the real demands that we have at the table, and one thing that we've been spending a lot of time talking about recently, is how do we solve this problem of TAs being overworked and also being unable to give the adequate attention to their students. Like, TAs are often having to close their office hours door when there's still a line out the door. They're having to, they're being instructed to not give comments on papers because they don't have time. It's all connected to the problem of the quality of education.
Yeah. So TA hours, the lengths of our contracts are getting cut arbitrarily, no reason, no notice. In psychology in the fall, they were cut from 180 to 150 hours. In religious studies, from 100 to 80 hours, with no change in the amount of enrollment or work. And so they're saying, we're decreasing the quality of education by reducing the amount of time that TAs have for grading, feedback, emails, office hours. And we're pressuring our TAs to work for free because TAs give a shit about undergrad education. They're some of the most passionate teachers I know. And the biggest reticence that people had to going on strike was that they cared so much about the undergrads that they didn't want to affect their education. But clearly, you know, McGill has been giving us very, very little, and so we've been left with no choice other than to up the stakes and show them that, like, listen, we care about education and we care about ourselves, and we're not going to accept this anymore.
While they say they don't want to harm student learning, the TAs hope this exam time disruption will push McGill to take their demands seriously. So far, the university hasn't responded, at least not publicly, except for an FAQ section on their website and a statement affirming employees' right to strike. CQUT has reached out to McGill to verify a number of the claims made in this piece, but they've responded with only the following message. And I quote, McGill is not commenting on details of the labor dispute with teaching assistants, aside from noting that the university deeply values their contributions and recognizes their right to labor action within the parameters of the law. McGill looks forward to continuing discussions with the union for the renewal of the collective agreement. The university is continuing its operations, prioritizing the measures necessary to ensure that students are not unduly affected by the labor action. And so what does this look like in practice? It's actually been quite the point of contention. McGill is saying in the FAQ section of their website that profs are able to step in and assume the duties of the TAs that they supervise. Basically, that this is part of their normal work as professors, and that they also count as managers of TAs, which under the law qualifies them to do TA work during the strike. Here's Barry Eidlin, an associate professor of sociology and labor relations expert at McGill, discussing McGill's shifting position and the problems this might create within labor law.
They were saying that the work done by our TAs consists of part of our quote-unquote normal faculty duties, and that we are responsible for all the evaluation involved with all of our courses and our course design and every and all the instruction. And then we just happen to have these helpful TAs that sort of do this stuff for us normally, but in the event that they are not available for whatever reason, it's still our responsibility to cover all this work. In this recent FAQ that they have come out with, they have sort of, they initially were saying that academics are not managers. Now they are saying that we do count as managers because we have authority over how to direct the work of our TAs. We have, we can assign them certain tasks and we can supervise them in different ways. And so the hiring firing thing is just one criteria of many, and we satisfy all these other criteria, and therefore as managers we are entitled and indeed ordered to do the work of normally done by TAs in the event of a strike.
And just
asserting this is the case when the case law is actually far from settled on the matter.
Eidlin also says that the McGill Association of Teachers has received legal counsel saying that profs don't count as managers. AGSEM holds the same position. So what does this mean for professors who are trying to figure out what to do in case of a strike, especially when McGill is asking them to pick up the slack? Well, Barry Eidlin says that what they should do is think about the spirit of the laws. Now, Quebec has strong anti-scab protections, and he says profs, if they're in doubt over what to do, should remember exactly why the province put those laws in place and why they're gaining traction across the rest of Canada.
Quebec is one of two provinces, or two jurisdictions, because we also have to include the federal jurisdiction in Canada, that have anti-scab legislation. And what that means is that it's prohibited for an employer to bring in people to do work that would otherwise be done by the workers who are part of the bargaining unit that's on strike. Quebec is the pioneer in this legislation. It has existed on the books in Quebec since 1978. British Columbia is the other that enacted it in 1993. The Manitoba government is currently preparing. There's a new NDP government that was elected late last year, and one of their promises was to enact this. And then on February 27th, I believe, the Canadian House of Commons unanimously voted for anti-SCAP legislation. So even Pierre Poilievre voted for anti-SCAP legislation.
That's good.
So this is part, so I guess one thing is to understand this is sort of part of a growing consensus in Canada in the labor relations sphere. Scabbing is detrimental to the collective bargaining process. What's important to understand here is the role of strikes in the broader collective bargaining relationship. And the purpose of collective bargaining is to reach an agreement on a variety of things related to the working conditions, wages, that kind of thing that affect workers. And the reason that strikes factor into this is because the collective bargaining relationship is inherently involves an unequal power balance, power imbalance.
Interesting, yeah.
Where employers have all sorts of structural power advantages over the workers that they employ. Yeah. And in order to level the playing field and have an equitable bargaining process that can actually reach a bargaining agreement, it's important that workers also have certain levers at their disposal to exert pressure on the employer. Otherwise, you're left with this unequal power imbalance, and you're not able to actually address the underlying problems in the workplace. And so the fundamental, ultimate power that workers have is to withdraw their labor. And the purpose of that withdrawal of labor is to create pressure on the employer to compel them to come to the bargaining table and reach an agreement.
Even if McGill doesn't come to an agreement with its TAs, there are still things the TAs say would make their lives easier. The first thing is to let them into the workday HR system the TAs use day to day. That system is where their tax documents are all stored. And as you may or may not know, it's tax season. People have already expressed frustration that they can't get what they need to file, which McGill is obligated by law to provide. McGill has also taken the position that TAs can't do their other work on campus. Now, I'm not talking about coursework here. I'm talking about work as research assistants or other casual jobs on campus. They're simply not allowed. Now, McGill says this is because of Quebec labor law. Once again, AGSEM disagrees, and they say that McGill is within its rights to budge and come to an agreement so that TAs aren't getting double punishment for going on strike. At the end of the day, TAs say they'll stay on strike until they can get a fair deal, one that helps not just them, but also students at McGill. That's why TAs are asking students to stand in solidarity with them in the ongoing weeks of strikes.
Show up to the picket line. Almost every day of the week, we're going to be at Roddick Gates. And whenever you see us, you know, give us a thumbs up. Join if you have some time. I promise it's super fun. But the other really big things that you can do are emailing your professors, the chairs of your departments, deans of your faculties, and the president of the university to say, the TA demands are reasonable. I appreciate them. I want them back, and it's your responsibility to end this strike by giving them the deal they deserve.
McGill administration has a very easy solution to the problem of graduating students and vulnerable students with visa issues, and that's to reach an agreement.
You can find more information about AGSEM's demands at agsem.ca. That's AGSEM.ca. McGill's position, as expressed in its FAQ about the labor disruption, is also available online. You can go to mcgill.ca/HR to read the details. I'm Jules Pigel with files from Sequoia Kim, Kai Samuel Sablowski, and Elnathan Amdetsian. Thanks for listening.
Through the workers' blood shall run. There can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
That's been our show today. You've been listening to the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup here on CKUT. I'm your host, Jules Bigel, and these are some of the stories that I've been covering at the station with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative. As always, you can find most of what I do online at ckut.ca/LJI. The slight delay from when they're aired. You're also going to be hearing coming up soon this week a piece about La Petite Drone closing, but if you want to get a first listen to that, you can head to the website. Thanks again for everybody who donated during our funding drive last week. We were able to raise the $15,000 that's really necessary to support the work at the station, work that my colleagues do, work that our other programmers do, and work that's supporting our growing news collective. So thank you. Keep listening to the station, and yeah, have a great Tuesday night. Have a great week.
We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever.
It's part of your job, hobby, to give a man back the dignity he once had. Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a man. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow. And hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. When they hang my husband, is that just?
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Yasmin, and I'll be your host for today. We would like to acknowledge that CKUT is located on unceded Haudenosaunee, Anishinaabeg,